Picture this. You're new to the world of aviation. You've been drawn in by something you've experienced that fascinated you. Maybe a flight, maybe a type of aircraft, maybe an episode of Air Crash Investigations. In any case, you think you're ready to invest in aviation as an interest or a hobby, but you're not sure where to start. Luckily, there's only one logical answer. Collectors Aircraft Models Australia. They're Australia's largest outlet in die-cast, wooden-carved, and push-fit aircraft models. And they don't just cover commercial flying, but also military, sport, and general aviation too. And while you might have worries as to how long you might have to wait to get the model you want, or maybe you aren't sure how reliable the model is, well, Camos source their stock from leading manufacturers from both within Australia and the world over, regularly receiving updates from manufacturers and suppliers as to what's new and being developed. Oh, and what if you spot an issue with the model you bought? Well, Camos will replace your defective model with a fully intact one with no fuss and no extra charge. So don't wait any longer. Head into Camos and secure your model today. 40 Cranwell Street, Braybrook. There's no reason not to.
Can I really start a feud with any airline? Like,
I do need to be careful in what I say here.
Yes, yes, you absolutely could.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
You're the 737 expert, Christos. Name an airline. You could probably tell me if they operate 737.
I probably could. Now they're just an airline.
Southwest.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Probably is. I mean...
So why should we be excited about the Singapore A380?
I don't know. I like the A350.
So, wow. Sorry. Go on.
Mate. Oh, thank you for cutting me off there, Russ, but...
Love you, Nick.
Wait.
That blew my eardrums.
Yes, they did.
That's great. Way too much.
Live in Melbourne and across the aviation world, this is Radio Runway.
That's right. We're back here gracing your ears. Been a long time, but we miss it every time that we have a break in between episodes, don't we, Nick?
Yeah, it's just me and you again today, Tom, and a special guest.
We finally have Scott Conway, Mr. Fact Check himself.
Yeah, Mr. Fact Checker.
How are you, Dad?
Flesh.
Good, thank you. As one of the many millions of people who have listened to every single episode of the podcast.
That's right.
We do have a very, very large listener base.
We do. And most of that listener base is definitely not like our friends and family. Definitely like a bunch of randoms that tune in.
That's correct. Yeah. A large following in the US and the UK. And in the UK, and Singapore. Actually, no, Singapore. And definitely not just your dad in Singapore listening away.
No, there's my mum as well. So,
of course. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, it's been a long time coming. I'm excited to have you on, Dad, to be honest, because we've got a lot of cool stuff to talk about, and there's a lot that's happened in since we last talked. It's funny. I think when we last had an episode, we were talking about it was the door blowout had freshly happened, and we were talking about how Boeing have a lot to fix and a lot to take a look at internally, and it's just gotten worse since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's gone to the stage now where I feel they've even admitted that just things aren't going well for them at the moment. They've fully admitted that quality control is a massive issue for them. Last week we saw that the CEO of Boeing has stepped down.
Calhoun, that's right.
Dave Calhoun, as well as some executives such as Stan Deal, who'll be stepping out as well. So I don't know. Will we see a change in Boeing? I don't know. I think with all things in aviation regarding safety, it's the Swiss cheese model. It isn't just one thing. It's multiple things that add up into one. But obviously, with the sort of executives, the buck stops at them.
Yep.
So it's
about $86 million bucks usually, because that's how much they get when they
get flight.
What is with these golden parachutes? Hey,
yeah.
It's the same with Alan Joyce, and it will be the same with Calhoun.
Yeah,
they all just get...
Well, Muhlenberg was the same as well. Mm. Muhlenberg, the previous CEO to Calhoun, who was responsible for the 737 MAX crashes, the one in Ethiopia, the one in Indonesia, he got a payout of about $80 million and no criminal charges, which is crazy.
Yeah. I think since the last podcast, we had that LATAM Airlines flight from Sydney to Auckland that
That was crazy.
I was actually on that flight 12 days beforehand. So
yeah, exact flight. From Sydney to Auckland.
It was a really good flight. It's a great airline, and it was very comfortable on the 787 there. But fortunately, I wasn't dropping 3,000 feet in a couple of seconds. So
yeah, and also the 737, the random panel blowout with United, and then also the 777 United hydraulic leak as well.
Yeah,
and then also last week, multiple airline CEOs requested to consult the Boeing board without the presence of David Calhoun there as well. Oh my gosh.
There's a lot of Boeing. There's been a lot of United as well. The LATAM one is so interesting one though. Because there was no evidence to show that it dropped several hundred or thousand feet. I can't remember what it was. And then they didn't categorize it as cat turbulence either. Like,
yeah.
There was some suggestion that by poor design of the layout of the buttons and stuff in the cockpit, that the where the pilot's seat control adjustment was too close to some other button, and he's actually knocked that when he's getting back into his seat, and that's what causes the plane into it. Yeah, that hasn't been confirmed. That was one of the theories being postulated.
That's happened before. Atlas Air 767 in Miami in 2019 or 2020, one of the two, operating on behalf of Prime Air. And the first officer who was piloting control, they were coming down in descent, and he had the speed brake active, and he realized that they've come to a good descent speed now. So he goes to turn the speed brake off, but as he has to reach around because he's in the right-hand seat, he has to reach around to the left-hand side where the speed brake is, and as he's pushing the speed brake forward, the buckle of his watch gets caught on the thruster, and the thrust goes full forward, and they start ascending rather than descending. And because they're in the middle of like heavy fog and weather, they didn't realize. And it took them like 6,000 feet of ascent before they realized they were not at flight level, like, you know, flight level six, or, you know, 6,000 feet. Yeah, they were like 12,000 feet. So it definitely does happen.
It has happened before, because obviously if the autopilot's on and you actually start turning the control column, it will disengage the autopilot. And that has happened in a few airline accidents where someone's knocked, they thought it was on autopilot, they've knocked the steering wheel effectively and disengaged the autopilot and not realized.
Oh my gosh.
So these can happen, but that's why you have two pilots. Hopefully one of them will notice.
More air pilot.
If they're not both asleep, like that, was it the Lion Air one recently where
both
pilots were asleep for 20 minutes?
Yeah. Are you serious? That actually did happen. Did actually happen.
Crew fatigue? Who knows? There'll be an investigation in that.
So I think Boeing at the moment have been saved by the fact that there's really only one alternative, that's Airbus, and they've both got these huge multi-year backlogs, and so people have got all these Boeing orders, and certainly sunk costs in terms of their Boeing fleets. They can't do anything else.
That is a question, actually. Talking of the duopoly, and there are a few companies that have come close to breaking into at least the narrow market.
You're talking about Comac?
No. So Comac,
I'd still fly Boeing over Comac.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%. I'd fly an MH370 before I flew on Comac. Okay, I can't say that. But talking of Comac, little side detail when it comes to Comac actually is the actual Comac board have discussed Comac, the Western Comac, and Comac, the Chinese Comac, which is their ultimate goal, which is to have all parts manufactured and generated in China, including the turbines, including the engines, which right now they're using Pratt Whitney engines. And they probably will continue to for a fair while.
Yeah.
But their ultimate goal is to pull away from the, quote, Western C919, which I find is interesting that they consider it to be Western, given, you know, the airframe is holistically Chinese.
Yeah.
Just a few other bits and pieces here. Anyway, that's a different side. Now, I was going to say, so there's a few different manufacturers trying to break, that have almost broken into the narrow market. You had Bombardier. Obviously, they sold their design for the C-Series to Airbus. It became the A220.
What a fantastic aircraft.
That is a fantastic aircraft. And actually, before we get to the A220, there is...
Tom's about to flex the fact that he's flown around.
Well, he has too.
Oh, yeah.
Officially.
Yeah,
we'll get to that shortly.
And Tom's sister, though, she got to go on the one with the...
Yeah, well, guess so does he. Because, in fact, you know what? Let's talk about here. I'll run through the weekly wrap-up, and then we can talk about the A220 experience, shall we say.
Well, he also went business class both ways, if I recall. So.
That's right. Here we go.
This week on Radio Runway.
While the official launch has long since passed, the boys officially this week christened the A220 fleet at Qantas, testing out the entire fleet to date from Melbourne to Canberra and back. And by entire fleet, I mean the only two aircraft that they have. Well, everyone, it's official. All four of your fantastic podcast hosts are now working in the aviation industry in some way. And while we'd love to tell you about what we do, maybe not over a podcast. In any case, having all four of us so close to the action makes us even more excited to talk about everything that's happening in the aviation industry.
Very excited.
And finally, first there was Alan Joyce, then there was Michael O'Leary. Which CEO are we going to soundbite next? Please drop us a line on Instagram or an email to tell us which CEO we should make as our official soundbite next. That's the fortnightly wrap-up. Now back to the episode.
Yes, so Nick, we spoke there about the A220 christening that yourself and Ross took it through. I as well, the week before that, got a chance to go on X4 Bravo, which is the most recent of the two.
Mm-hmm.
That's the regular Q-Link livery.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You guys actually went X4 Alpha up on the fantastic green Indigenous livery.
Yeah.
And then back on Bravo.
Yeah.
In the same day, which is pretty boss.
Not in the same day. It was like within 2 hours.
That's
crazy. We were in Canberra for 1 hour.
Can I just say,
we got out, went to Parliament House. Ross took a photo, told his parents that he was in Canberra. By the way, he hadn't told his parents that night that he was going to go to Canberra. He literally just dropped it on them. Hey, I'm in Canberra. Do you want anything?
That's then, kind of boss, actually.
Yeah. And then we were like, yep, we've seen it. We'll go home. There's a flight that leaves in half an hour. Well, it was actually, no, I lie. It was 37 minutes because we had 7 minutes to book the flight because we couldn't book it once checked in closed.
Yeah, that's right.
We ended up going up on X4 Alpha and back on X4 Bravo. It is such a fantastic aircraft, though. Yeah. You've been on it as well. You've been on X4 Bravo, obviously.
I think the actual ergonomic experience was fantastic. And I think the actual product business, and you went back and sat in economy to test it out as well, actually, I noticed.
We went both ways in business. That's such a wankerish thing to say, Melbourne to Canberra in business.
But you know what though? Like, hey, we have to experience the product.
Yeah,
the product.
Look, I walked to the back of the aircraft. It was a really smooth flight on both legs. To be honest, the seatbelt sign came off really quickly. So I had to wander around the aircraft, checked out, you know, just stuff like the lavatories and that sort of stuff. The economy seating, it's so much, like, in terms of width, I'd say it's the same as a 7.3, but in terms of legroom, I feel as though you get more.
Mm.
The seat, obviously, is a lot more comfortable compared to a 7.3. Like, I would rather fly a 220 from, like, say, Melbourne to Brisbane than a 7.3, to be honest.
Mm.
It's far more comfy. And then the toilets are, you know, they're small, but it's a small aircraft, but it's really modern, it's really clean. It's well looked after.
Did you feel as though, sorry, this is something I thought, and it's for one very obvious reason. The cabin during day flying, much brighter because the windows are huge.
Yeah, the windows are absolutely massive. And at night, they have this really nice sort of mood lighting going on. Like not to the extent that you'd see on
you guys traveled when the sun was coming down, right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. So when we landed in Melbourne, it was dark. So we managed to see like the mood lighting that was going on there. And it wasn't as like, you know, obviously it wasn't as nice as what you'd find in something like an A350 where they've poured millions of dollars into like just sort of technology. That, you know, like Qatar Airways and Emirates and that sort of stuff. They go all out on the mood lighting. Like Emirates have stars on the ceiling. And stuff like that. It's nuts, but it's really nice. And I'm comparing this to the 737 because I haven't been on the 717 yet.
Really?
No, I haven't. I'm gonna have to go on it soon before it retires.
You're not missing much, to be
I often tell people I went on the 717 And they're like, oh, with Qantas, because, you know, in Australia right
yeah,
now, you can
exactly.
only travel with Qantas on the 717. I said, no, Jetstar. They're always like, Jetstar?
Yeah.
But yeah, Jetstar used to have the 71s.
It was like June, July 2005, if I recall correctly.
2005.
That's
Coolangatta to Melbourne.
It was, and it was weird really? Because, you know, the plane was like half full, and they still had to make sure that not too many people sat at the front, not too many people sat at the back, and even I was thinking, this is like, I don't know, it was 80-seat aircraft. Still worried about it's going to be unbalanced. It was a bit of a
yeah.
bit of concern, but did the job.
I remember very specifically thinking how cool it was. I was like 10 years old. How cool it was that I'm traveling on an aircraft that had their turbines at the rear where the yeah. tail is.
Yeah.
Blew yeah. my mind.
That's all I really want to go on the 717 on is to like sit right in front of those engines. And look out the window and see them going full pelt down the runway.
And turn to Christos and go, yeah. did you know there's an engine right there?
Yeah. My goodness. He loved that day.
I know.
I could probably fit in the luggage compartment easy.
I want to talk about, though, yeah. Canberra Airport. It has no right to be as nice as it is.
It is really
it
nice.
It is such
it?
A nice airport. My goodness. Like, it's a small airport. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't need to be big. But, like, it's literally an art museum. To be honest, and there's
National Gateway,
National Gateway, the National Gateway into the nation's capital. But I will say one thing: I think that one of the defining features that makes it feel that way is similar to, there's one key difference between what I'm about to say, but it's similar to Shanghai Airport, Pudong Airport, in the sense that it's got floor-to-ceiling glass windows that look out across the apron. Now, obviously, the difference there is that Canberra, you're looking across these beautiful green meadows with hill mountain range in the background, and it's amazing. Pudong, not so much. You're looking at factories and misty air.
Yeah, it's smog. Yeah,
exactly.
and the fact that Pudong Airport's about 3 kilometres long, like the actual terminals is one huge, big, long.
That's right. Yeah, shit. So defining differences there, but in a sense, like, it feels more incredible because of how much of the natural light that's coming in and the view across the beautiful green apron that you have as well. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's such a nice airport. And then we landed back in Melbourne in the Dash 8 bays that was going under construction, and it was just like this shed. You've got a city that has
it's the Alpha Gates, right?
Yeah.
At Melbourne Airport, yeah.
Like 500,000 people, I think, in Canberra, which is 10% of the population of that in Melbourne, and the airport, like,
it's
the
so
gates
nice.
Of what we landed in Melbourne. Oh my, it was just a shed.
Canberra in general was quite nice. I was impressive. For a city that's been purpose-built to be the capital of Australia, capital territory of Australia, I was very impressed. The way that the city's, like, the municipalities maintained was fantastic.
Yeah, it's a very clean city. It's a very well laid out city, designed by Walter Burley Griffin,
an American.
Well,
there you go.
But yeah, it is a very well laid out city, very clean. I can see why people get bored there pretty easily, but it is a very nice city though.
Yeah.
And I think I would definitely go back for more than an hour. Mm. Next time.
Yeah, it's left a good imprint on our memories.
Yeah, but...
yeah. Actually, speaking of memory, Scotty boy, Dad, I need to ask you, because we tend to do this with our guests, but what is your favourite aviation memory?
Well, I'll give you three. Three very brief but quite different memories.
Okay.
In chronological order. Once, the first time, in fact, the only time I've ever been on a helicopter. I was about 9 years old, and I was living in Malaysia, up in the highlands of Malaysia. And one of my mates' dad owned Southeast Asian Helicopters.
Whoa.
And he brought the helicopter down to school one weekend. And we landed on the local golf course, and he just took us on these joyrides around
That's the highlands. Cool.
And it was a Huge 500, now known as the MD-500. Would have been an iconic helicopter for its day.
Goodness.
And it's just four people in it, but it was fantastic. And it was so that was my first helicopter memory. Second one was the Farnborough Air Show, 1992.
Flex.
No, yeah.
And that was the Farnborough debut of the A340, actually.
Oh, really?
And there's a whole, and you could, back then, not like, like if you go to the Avalon one, you know, obviously they have grandstands right up against the runway. But at Farnborough, you could just walk right up there. It's just basically a small fence. You can stand right up near the runway. And they were doing these low speed, like mini stall bypasses on the A340. It was fantastic. And all the static displays, like they had, the US Air Force had the entire range of F-15s, 14s, 16s, and you could, and unlike Avalon, where it's all roped off, you can go right up and touch them. The pilots there to talk to. And then they had mock dog fights with the latest Sukhoi 25, which is the Russian fighter at the time, doing that as well.
Top Gun style.
Yeah.
They actually, talking about the Hughes 500, they had the latest version of that, which was the first one to come out with no tail rotor. It forces air along the beam behind the helicopter and uses the air direction to stabilize the back of the helicopter rather than the rear rotor. Gosh. And it can fly upside down. So they're doing all sorts of stunts on the MD-500. So, yeah, that was great memories of Farnborough Air Show. And then the third one was probably the first time I flew internationally business class. It wasn't the first time I'd been business class. It was the first time I'd done it for work. I was going from Melbourne to Hong Kong. And it was 10 o'clock on a Monday morning. I'm sitting in business class watching a movie. They're bringing me ice cream and chocolates. And I think, hey, I finally made it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
This is what I want. I could be back at my desk in Box Hill working, but no, here I am.
And what was the flight specifically? Do you remember?
It was an A330, which I've never been a great fan of, to be quite honest with you. I used to fly.
Well, you're not alone on that one.
I remember the first time I flew an A330 was actually when Qantas first got them, and they were flying domestically, Melbourne, Sydney, and this thing was so rattly. We were taxiing out from the gate to the end of the runway in Melbourne, and it was just bumping, bump, 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 and everything shaking and rattling, and the pre-flight videos going on the screen saying, "You're flying on the latest, Qantas' latest A330. A smoother, more quieter experience." And just then one of the overhead lockers fell out. Yeah. It was so bumpy. Everyone just burst out laughing. It was so funny.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I hope you're listening to this, Christos, because we know you're a fan of the A330, but no. Just no.
So, yeah, three quick memories.
There you go.
It's passed its sell-by date, 330 has.
Yeah.
My goodness, it has.
It really has. It's time to say goodbye, A330. Far out. Okay, so we had helicopter, we had business class.
And Farnborough Show.
Farnborough is still a flex.
Farnborough's cool. You've been to the Paris one, though.
Did go to Paris Air Show. I got there the day after the 777X had gone home. But I did see the MAX 10 there. Or was it the MAX 8? One of the MAX 8, MAX test body
Riyadh,
aircraft.
You saw the Riyadh 787
One of the ones that still has the middle door on it.
That's right. One of the ones that still has the door functioning. Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I saw the Riyadh 78. I saw an Air France A220. I saw the A350 XWB, the 10 abreast special.
You didn't go in it though, did you?
Didn't go in it.
But you saw the outside.
You wouldn't fit in it if you tried to sit in.
Yeah, well, with the layout.
Hey, but Kobe Explained says it's not too bad, though. But he said it in the video where he sat down and he was the only person in that row. He's like, it's not too bad.
I know.
I'm like, hey, how about you get three other people to sit next to you and tell me it's not too bad? Like, you know,
Exactly. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yes. Well, look, I'll just quickly touch on what I was going to say earlier about other aircraft trying to break into the duopoly. Mm-hmm. Just circle back to that for a second. So I was trying to basically say, Bombardier sold their design for the C-Series to Airbus. It became the A220. Fantastic aircraft. That was partially Bombardier obviously putting out feelers and then offering companies to buy it, and partially because the duopoly wants to maintain their duopoly, right?
Yeah.
It's a combination of both. Well, I learned recently that pre-COVID, there was almost another contender to the narrow-body market that had 500 orders, and they only fulfilled 9 of them while still building and developing this aircraft. And then COVID came along, and it's sort of been blamed for a lot of the manufacturing issues that they've had. And so right now it's on hold, and it's not looking likely it will come back. and that was the Mitsubishi Regional Jet, the NRJ, or the MRJ. Yeah, yeah.
The Mitsubishi.
Yeah, Mitsubishi. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Mitsubishi MRJ, which was supposed to be a competitor to like Embraer's E175 E2, which, by the way, kind of funny that Embraer purpose built the E175 E2 to break into the US domestic market, and then it didn't actually fit the scope, the regulatory scope for regional aircraft, and so it actually accidentally locked itself out of its intended market.
Yeah.
They're not a bad aircraft, those Embraers. I've been on E190, I think, in North a couple of years ago.
Indigove. Up north, that's right. Yes, and we've seen the Prophet Hunter, of course.
We have, It was a good-looking aircraft.
It was. And the Prophet Hunter was actually also at Paris. So,
it goes to all the air shows, I feel.
Yeah.
It's like any big air show. It was at the Singapore air show as well.
The Honeywell 757 test body aircraft.
Yeah, that was cool.
Apparently, that test body is how aviation, commercial aviation onboard Wi-Fi was born. Through that aircraft. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. Mm. All right, fellas. Well, I have a black box segment this week. It's not particularly in-depth, but it is a pretty cool topic we need to talk about. And actually, it will tie in nicely with what we threw out to the Instagram, which is to ask questions. We asked some questions to our listeners, what should we talk about? And Gabby, one of our listeners, came back and said, talk about something to do with airports. And actually, Gabby, I hear you because I love airports.
Gabby also asked us to talk about Manila Airport and the
specifically Manila Airport
and the PPP.
Proserpine.
But I said to Gabby,
yeah,
if we want to talk about Manila Airport, we can get her on.
Yeah, I think that's good.
She's done a lot of work on that. And
okay,
she said it was a mix of aviation and corruption, which is what we love. Okay. Which you can just rephrase as aviation, to be honest.
I thought we finished talking about Boeing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it sounds like she knows a lot about it, so she might be the perfect person to get on to talk about it.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll leave that for now. But Gabby, we will talk about something to do with airports. So let's bring in the black box. Here we go.
Black box.
Whoa. guys, I want to talk today about why it is that Western Sydney International Airport is needed, and what's more, how cool it is that we are seeing for the first time in decades an airport be built from scratch in real time, for all of Australia to watch unfold with all the latest and greatest airport technology. Fingers crossed, hopefully, and seeing everything from scratch rather than it just being putting a facelift on something that's 40 years old or something like that.
Melbourne Airport, what?
Yeah, that's correct. So I have done a deep dive specifically into the statistics around Sydney Airport and why it is that Western Sydney Airport, or WSI, is needed. So I'm going to start from there. Here we go. So looking at the history of airports around the world, almost always a new airport is built because either the current airport is outdated and can't continue supporting a growing modern aviation industry, or it is simply too busy and has no room to grow. And for our non-Australian listeners, let's make it obvious for you here, because this is the city of Sydney and this is Sydney Airport. Plain and simple, it is a heavily suburban area with no room to grow in any direction other than into the harbour, which, if you know Australia, you know that that's simply not going to happen.
Well, it's already in the harbour, actually, technically. They're both those runways.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's not going to be going any further. Which tells us, in simple terms, that Sydney's traffic growth eventually will hit a ceiling. It is only a matter of time. And such a prediction was one that was obvious enough, even for the politicians of Australia, which is really saying something. But again, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm not here to say Sydney Airport bad, new airport good. No. I want to give you guys the cold hard stats that show in no uncertain terms what Western Sydney Airport that Western Sydney Airport was always inevitable.
So I went back through Australia's Bureau of Infrastructure and Transport Research Economics, their data on Sydney Airport passenger traffic. And from 2015 to 2019, Sydney Airport saw an average year-on-year increase in annual passenger movements of 3.5%, increasing its yearly passenger movements over those 5 years by a little under 5 million passengers. And that's a nice steady growth rate until you look at the change in passenger numbers from 2018 to 2019, and then questions are raised. The year-on-year passenger numbers actually went down by just shy of 1,000 passengers. Almost 44,430,000 passengers moved through Sydney Airport in 2018, and that went down to 44,429,000 the year after. And why the sudden stagnation in passenger movement growth? Remembering that the COVID-19 pandemic began in March of 2020, and these stats are measured by calendar year as indicated by the Bureau of Infrastructure and Transport Research Economics. So I think if we can take anything out of the stagnation, the clear stagnation from 2018 to 2019 in terms of passenger growth, it is that is Sydney Airport's ceiling. With no room to grow, stuck in a suburban area and hence limited by a curfew as well, Sydney Airport is limited by a very clear maximum number of movements per day. The passenger movement data here clearly shows us that ceiling. And it is one of the best examples for why a second major airport in Sydney is needed. One that won't have its continual expansion limited by its surroundings. An airport that won't be limited by a curfew, meaning that there are no hard final landing times, as well as the possibility to act as a safety net for any problems that arise outside of Sydney Airport's curfew window. So that is essentially the picture around Sydney's current situation. Well, not current, because the passenger growth and passenger movements and daily, movement slots, that's still, climbing back from pre-COVID levels. So COVID sort of disrupted the data there. But you can see from 2018 to 2019, that stagnation, that's really a shining, clear example for why it is that WSI is needed. And luckily, the politicians have been talking about it for many years because and experts in the field have been talking about it for many years because they could see that it was coming, right? They could see that Sydney's not going to be able to expand in any direction. It eventually is going to need a replacement. Something like Melbourne, right, where you've got so much land around that you can continually expand and build upon. There's no curfew. You know what I mean?
It's interesting, actually, because I wonder how much, particularly with cargo, how much more traffic Sydney could accept if the curfew didn't exist, particularly with cargo operations, which happens predominantly overnight. Because what's ironic is that the curfew exists because of the politicians.
Yeah,
it's purely political. There's a lot of politicians that live around that area, and they say no, don't want flights at night.
Well, but do you think it's got to be some form of
pressure from the residents as well?
Oh, okay, right. That's what I'm saying. Like, I think it's definitely political pressure, but I think it's not just political. It's not just the politicians saying, "Oh, we don't want flying over." It's probably there is their constituents, like they want to stay elected, and part of that might be listening to the constituents saying, "We need a curfew," I guess.
Yeah. So. I think Western Sydney though will be good. Sydney Airport as it stands at the moment, as you said, there's no space to grow, except for into the harbour, which they won't do. I guess the good thing though about Sydney Airport currently is the proximity from the actual terminal to the CBD.
Pretty good. Yeah.
I mean, particularly domestic. I mean, how many stops do you have on the train? You've got Mascot, Green Square,
six or something. Yeah. Not very much.
No, it's not.
Except they do charge you like $15 or $20 to get.
Yeah there's a way out of that. Almost you catch the bus to Mascot. And then catch the train.
I know.
And skip it.
Done that many times.
Yeah.
But I was gonna say, so I have not looked into the exact details of the public transport infrastructure from WSI.
They're building a big train out there.
They're going to build a train out there. Wow, so that is interesting. Off the bat, they're building a train line from WSI to Sydney, or at least connecting to a regional line, and yet Melbourne Airport still does not have
Yeah, look, I think the freight's an interesting one because I don't know what the plans are with WSI in terms of passenger movements. I mean, Qantas has got such a huge sunk cost in infrastructure at Mascot, so you're going to convince them to move some of that to WSI. Mm. Another thing, too, in terms of passengers, the network effect is really important because this is why Avalon's never really taken off because, yes, there's a certain number of people who want to fly from A to B, but there's a huge percentage of those people when they get to B want to connect to a C. And so if you don't have those international connections through WSI, there's going to be a lot of people who don't want to fly domestically into WSI because they want to connect. Mm. But the freight, yeah, maybe because Dubai do that same thing, don't they? They have the main airport.
Yeah, they have DWC, Al Maktoum.
Yeah, where they fly all the cargo in there, though they are talking about actually moving the entire operation out to the freight airport because it's so much bigger and won't be as constrained. But but yeah, maybe it's a short to medium term thing. They could move all that cargo and free up that space. But actually, how much cargo actually flies into Sydney? Because like you say, most of it's done overnight anyway. So I don't.
Yeah, most of it's done overnight. But right now, all domestic cargo passenger movements have final airborne times of 2300, right? And so realistically, you have to have all freight prepared during the day and then moved by 2300.
And that 11 o'clock is a hard curfew. It's really strict.
I mean, it is.
The number of times people have been on finals, like 20 seconds from touchdown, no, you're off and you're flying to Newcastle, Brisbane
airlines,
or something.
Airlines will often have to weigh up the differential between profit on the particular route that you're flying, on the flight that you're flying, versus the dispensation that you're going to, you know, have to dig out of that profit.
Yeah. So I really do think the ability to convince airlines to set up shop in a meaningful way at WSI is going to be critical to its success because if no one wants to go there.
Yeah, that's right.
Unless it could be that one particular airline sort of sets up shop. I don't know. What I'm thinking right now is something like JFK and Newark. I mean, Newark, massive United base. I don't actually think that United currently flies into JFK. I think all their New York operations are EWR. But it's a massive Star Alliance hub. So even if you have, I don't know, something like a Virgin Australia set up shop there and you have all their partners that fly there and then you have Qantas base and a massive One World base in Kingsford Smith, something like that, that could work.
It's not a bad idea, actually, because Virgin doesn't have that international connections in terms of its own planes, really. There's a bit of South Pacific stuff, of course, but it doesn't have that big international network like Qantas does. Mm. The other thing is differential pricing. If you make the landing charges and the passenger head charge, all that heaps cheaper, it will attract certain airlines to go there.
Yeah, and also looking at the business model of Australia, well, of airlines around the world, the low-cost carrier, the ultra-low-cost carrier, a huge portion of their business model relies upon flying to and from secondary airports, not primary hubs. And that, so
Made for Jetstar.
Jetstar, Bonza, if they're still by the time it opens, you know? Bonza, because they've often, how many times have we heard Tim Jordan or 777 Partners in the news complaining about the fact that Sydney Airport, you know, slot availability and also the fees associated with it, blah, 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 not profitable, yada, yada, yada.
I think I've said this before, though, but you know Qatar Airways strongly held off flying to Sydney because their charges were so high? They only flew to Sydney since, like, 2015. For a long time, they never flew to Sydney, and the only reason behind it was because their landing and parking charges were so high.
Mm.
It's insane. And then they ended up sending two flights daily for a little while. They ended up being, one being like, you know, Doha, Sydney, and then they did that other one, Doha, Sydney, Canberra, and then COVID hit and they axed that, and then they made that second flight come to Melbourne and now goes to Adelaide and back. But
yeah,
it's so high in Sydney. But I could see something like Jetstar being based out at WSI, regional airlines, Rex, Link.
Yep.
Bonza could have an appearance there
because
I think the landing charges and that sort of stuff. It'd be like what Gatwick is to Heathrow, or even like Stansted.
Yeah.
It could be that. There's a lot of opportunities for it, but I think,
actually, also, speaking of the logistics of moving, of an airline moving a lot of their you know, their, I guess, resources or assets to WSI. Another question we can cover now from the Instagram, Flynn asking us to cover crew scheduling in some way. That's one thing to think about with WSI as well, is airlines have a Sydney base, but WSI is fairly west. You're not going to have a huge majority of those pilots that and cabin crew that are, you know, situated close to Sydney Airport because it's relative to where their workplace is. They're going to be expected to hike out to WSI, or do they open up a new crew base situated close to WSI?
Certain unnamed airlines can have Perth resident people based out of Melbourne.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and that is a thing also across the board. You know, most airlines don't have a Perth base, but they'll have Perth residents. And that's the same with how a lot of Virgin and Australia pilots, even though it's a Brisbane hub, they'll probably live out of Melbourne or Sydney. You know, it's all right now, like, it's very, very expensive to live in Sydney. So I'd imagine a lot of pilots that are Sydney-based pilots for whatever airline, whether it be Qantas, Jetstar, or Rex even, those pilots might not necessarily live in Sydney. They might be commuters. They might have...
No, you're 100% right. The cabin manager on my flight from Singapore, QF2, about a month ago, I was having a chat to her, and she's Adelaide-based. She's Sydney-based, but she lives in Adelaide.
Yeah, right.
So every time she goes to work, she has to... fly to Sydney.
To Sydney first, yeah.
Because it's so expensive.
It's got to be one of the only industries in the world that enables that so easily.
Yeah.
Well, worst I've heard, I met this person once, and her dad was a United Airlines DC-10 pilot. He lived in LA, I think it was. And he was based out of JFK. He had to fly. Well, maybe he's in Colorado. You know, he's based out of JFK. He used to have to fly transcontinental.
Oh my gosh! That is insane. Yeah.
Imagine if he got called out though, just to do like fly back to LA.
Oh my gosh! Be good though, because if it was one way, then they were going to send you back on passenger jet as a passenger on the jet. Just be like, oh, I'm fine.
I think though, as once it's established, the ecosystem and the residency and that all naturally builds up over time. You go out to in Melbourne here. How many people living in Tullamarine or, say, Sunbury, for example? There's a huge percentage of people living in those towns near the airport who are involved in jobs that are based at the airport of some way.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Over time.
So. That is so true. Again, like, I'm sure that's the same with Avalon. Even with the small amount of flights that are there, I'm sure there are people... that
lots of sheep out there too,
aren't I'm sure there are people that live in Geelong that work for the airlines,
Or even like Werribee or something, because it's not that far, is it?
True. Werribee, right? Yeah. So, Tarneit, that kind of way, And I'm sure that's the same, in other states as well, or even Gold Coast in Brisbane, they're like an hour and a half,
apart. Or even like the Sunny Coast. I can't see it,
that's an hour and a half the other way, Well, I'd imagine there'd be a bond to Sunny Coast base.
Yeah, well, that's where the head office is.
So that's from a crew scheduling perspective. Again, something. But
so
you're right.
What's the official opening date for WSI then?
Standby. I don't have that. Right.
Did all this research except for the actual opening date.
It's moved a couple of times.
Oh, that's to be expected though with most construction jobs.
And I'm assuming WSI won't have a curfew.
Nah,
which will be good.
Won't have a curfew.
Okay,
late 2026.
Western Sydney International Airport is set to open for domestic and international travellers and freight by late 26th. Preliminary flight paths for WSI were released in June of 2023. So we have the flight paths. There you go.
So they'll have a 10-year free run, and then by the time people start building houses under the flight path, and then they'll start, once they've been there a couple of years, start complaining.
I hope the city of Sydney, or, you know, the federal government, or, I mean, have they already leased it to APAC? I don't know. I don't know the details of the ownership, but I hope whatever the details are, it's similar to Melbourne in that they're essentially leasing the entire suburb or the entire region to the airport authorities, because that's basically what it is in Melbourne. I mean, APAC pretty much oversee the whole of Tullamarine, you know?
Do you know what Michael O'Leary, though, says about Heathrow, which is ironic because his airline doesn't fly into Heathrow and never will? He says, and it's a very true fact, that he doesn't understand why all these Heathrow residents complain about the noise coming from Heathrow, because they chose to live close to the airport. Because bear in mind, Heathrow has existed during the wars.
That's actually true.
It's been there. It's been there longer than anyone else has been alive to sort of see it. So if you live near Heathrow under the flight path, you have done that choosing, knowing that there is a flight path there. And his claim is that you can't complain.
On the Heathrow flight path, and it's not that bad because I like planes. it's actually a feature, not a bug, as far as I'm concerned. All the houses have double glazing and everything. So. Except when Concorde used to come over.
That's cool, that was next
level noise. But most of them, especially now, their planes are so quiet now. So, you know, Gatwick, you mentioned Gatwick before, because they're trying to get a second runway up there. They've only got the one runway. And again, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's in the middle of the countryside, but there's a village at one end of it. And they're all up in arms about the fact that they're going to have, you know, an extra runway. So now they're trying to get permission as an interim step to turn one of the taxiways into a second runaway.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like, that's literally Top Gun
style. That is Top Gun. From the new Top Gun.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Don't do it, Mav. Don't do it, Mav.
It's a short taxiway.
They call me beloved, caring, sensitive, shy, and retiring.
Oh. That's Michael O'Leary in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Yeah. The man is full of ideas or logical arguments.
Yeah. To be honest, all UK airports, I feel, need an extra runway. I mean, Michael O'Leary's been trying to get an extra runway at Stansted. I still think that there needs to be a third runway at Heathrow. I don't know whether that'll ever going. I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard because to get a third runway at Heathrow, they basically need to take out an entire town.
Yeah. Well, exactly. There's no spare land. They have to buy just a huge swath of houses and offices and everything. And
which is hard to do in the modern day. Yeah. Hard to do in the modern day. Hence, probably why Sydney hasn't done it. Also, what do you think the likelihood is that Sydney and WSI could end up being the same as Tullamarine and Avalon in terms of their respective relationship?
No, I think WSI is going to have a lot more scale right from day one. Avalon's never had the scale. I mean, they've got AirAsia flying out there for a few years, but it's just
just Jetstar. Actually, they announced that they'd be flying Avalon Brisbane recently.
Yeah, they just started.
How many flights are Jetstar? It's only a handful, isn't it?
So they have, I think they would have Gold Coast, they'd have a couple of Sydneys. That's it.
Yeah. You got Bonza as well. Yeah. But,
Avalon's never going to have the scale.
No, it's not. Nah, I agree with your dad. Yeah, I think from the get go, the scale of this airport's going to be massive.
The runway's so cool.
To be fair, though, Avalon can handle a lot of freight movement.
Mm-hmm.
The MotoGP, all that sort of stuff went out of Avalon. All the F1 stuff went out of Avalon. All this Taylor Swift stuff
Convenient because it's a bit further away.
What you know about Avalon is you can hold an air show there for an entire weekend and you only have to stop it four times for it just stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true.
No one actually notices.
Yes,
good airport for an air show.
It is
good airport for an air show.
Great airport. The Wall of Fire.
The Wall of Fire was good. It was really good. And we were running back to the car as well to make sure that we didn't get caught up in all the traffic.
Yeah.
Like we literally saw the first Wall of Fire. And we were like running back, making sure we didn't get caught up in the traffic.
And Ross, we tried to do like a recording bit, didn't we? Afterwards.
Oh, yeah, and then we didn't record it.
Yeah. All right, so the overall features. Single 3.7-kilometre runway. Terminal with a floor area of up to 90,000 square metres. Parking facilities for around 11,500 cars. On-site roads and utilities. Aprons, taxiways, other appropriate aviation facilities. And stage one works package, which is currently what they're nearing the end of. The bulk earthworks package, pavement and airside civil package, terminal and specialty works, and landside civil and building works. Now, speaking of the civil and building work, actually, they have announced a huge industrial precinct. They've announced a huge living space, like a huge suburban living space as well. Like almost like a brand new community, almost like they're what they're doing in Victoria in some places, like, you know, Mernda or Kinley or what they did with Craigieburn.
Yep.
Where it's like, you know, you'll have like shops, schools,
yeah,
parkland,
yeah, yeah,
everything. Yep. Golf course, probably mandatory, of yeah, course. So they're really trying to drive this thing home.
Mm. So maybe on your bucket list, you can put 2027 flying a 777X out of WSI.
Oh,
yeah.
Hopefully there's a 777X.
Hey, that's a question to the listeners. What'll come first, the 777X or WSI?
That's right.
That's a really good question.
That's right. That's a really good
question. With the way Boeing's going at the moment, I'm going to say WSI.
I'm going to say WSI too.
Although the 777X's problems predominantly span out of GE, to be honest. There's a bit of issue with the GE engines that are going
Heathrow
on.
Will have a third runway booked on the
Oh, gosh. Yep.
That was really good black box.
Yeah.
Yeah. WSI, very, very, very interesting. It's going to change the landscape of Sydney in terms of, you know, aviation and sort of, you know, accessibility into Sydney. We're going to see growth into Sydney, particularly with, you know, sort of more airlines coming in, more budget carriers, more frequencies.
Yep. It's going to be maybe end up like Haneda and Narita, where you got the inner city one and you got the one way out.
Yeah.
Except you won't have a farmer that owns a bit of land.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We managed to obtain all the land, not some farmer in the middle of it.
That's right. To sell, yeah. We also haven't had a national riot against.
That's true. That's true.
My brother-in-law went to Japan just back at the end of last year. He had to go to a conference there, and he flew into Haneda. And then he's in the city for a few days at the office there, and he's flying out at night back to Melbourne. He's thought, oh, I've still got time to go back to the hotel and get my stuff. So he goes back to the hotel, about to get the taxi to Haneda, and realise, oh, actually flying out of Narita, and he missed the flight.
Oh, no way!
Because he didn't remember a rookie error, but he didn't realise, so he ended up having to stay an extra day because he just didn't realise Narita was so far out of Tokyo. And
so funny.
Yeah, what is it? It's like 60 kilometres out of town.
It's
or
a fair whack.
It's a big drive.
It's like an hour by train.
Yeah.
Hour and a bit.
Yeah, because you flew there last year, didn't you?
I did. I flew into Haneda and out of Narita, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Very different, but Narita, I feel like Haneda is definitely way more crowded and definitely a lot more going on. Yeah. The culture shock walking out of the arrivals hall and just signage everywhere and a million different arrows and everything. And I hadn't activated the eSIM yet on my phone, so I didn't have Wi-Fi or anything. And I was just like, but Narita, it was a lot calmer. The airfield was a lot more sparse, obviously, as you can imagine. It was cool. The ramen place at Narita is really good.
The ramen place at Narita.
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the other questions from the listeners. Yeah. I know that Ross's dad, Vince, went absolutely mental.
He did. I'm gonna speed through these because a few of them are pretty irrelevant. Like this first one, the Collingwood Football Club. All I have to say there, Vince, is that Emirates sponsor them, and that's cool. That's all I really want to talk about. Second question, why do they not serve sausage rolls on all flights?
Talk to Donata Catering about that one.
Well, I tell you what, Vince, they serve really nice quiches. I had a really nice spinach quiche on a Qantas flight last month. Yeah. He hates anything to do with cheese, apparently. I was talking to Ross about this.
Really?
And he got served this massive cheesy quiche, and he absolutely hated it. Oh.
I love the quiches serve.
I had a really nice spinach quiche.
Tom goes
last
way
month.
Back with the Qantas food.
Yeah.
When Tom was about, six years old, we went to New Zealand and we got served up, it's basically a dry bit of toast with this braised beef like out of a can. It's a disgusting slop. Anyway, he scoffs it down. And as we're getting off the plane, he says to the flight attendant, "Thank you. That was the best meal I've ever had."
Oh, gosh.
And my wife's looking and she's like, "What do you mean?"
Mum wasn't impressed that I'd sort of left that impression with them.
The Qantas economy food was the best food he'd ever had.
Wasn't the best moment, but yeah, gosh, yeah, classic. So no, quiche is good. Actually, I'd prefer quiche over sausage roll.
Actually, I know Bonza don't really serve food, I suppose, but hot food. But
oh yeah,
that would be a classic Aussie iconic thing to serve if they were to do.
That's right. They'd be very bonza.
Well, it's very interesting. It ties in well into what Rose has actually asked us to do, which is an airline food comparison. So maybe just a quick one. What's the best meal you've ever had on an aircraft?
Best meal I've ever had.
The most memorable one, to be honest.
Eddie had 787 Tokyo to Abu Dhabi in business class.
Oh, here we go.
And I had like this insane like yellowfin tuna Credo, and it was just like just amazing. I can't even. I've got pictures. Maybe I'll put it up on the Instagram.
Yeah,
pictures.
You should.
It was insane. And then the dessert was like this insane, like chocolate mousse with like salted caramel ice cream.
Desserts in business class, honestly, like you can't fault them,
dude.
They're so nice,
dude.
Some of the airlines, I mean, Singapore Airlines used to do Haagen-Dazs ice cream. It was good.
Cathay do that. Yeah. Cathay.
In fact, I remember the Singapore Airlines. Silver Crest Lounge, they used to have a chocolate waterfall and with a whole bunch of marshmallows around the side. And you could just go up there with a little skewer, you stick the marshmallow into the chocolate thing. And then right next to it, they had an entire cabinet full of all these different Haagen-Dazs ice creams. Help yourself as much as you want.
That is insane.
Awesome. Yeah.
Bring back those lounges.
Well, Singapore Airlines have lobster thermidor that you can order in their business class. Yeah, they do this thing called Book the Cook, and it's honestly the most extensive menu you'll ever see. You pre-order your meals. It's insane.
Far out.
But
non-stop.
You've been on a lot of flights, haven't you, Scott? So I'll be interested to see what your most memorable meal is on an aircraft.
I don't know. It's hard because it is a while ago, because I used to travel a lot business class for work and stuff, but that was going back a few years now. I haven't travelled business class to work probably for 4 years now. Since I went to the UK, I was on Qantas and Emirates and British Airways. To be honest with you, I've never found airline food, even a business class, that wonderful.
Yeah,
It's hard to do. Because even in business class, usually the cutlery is always blunt. Even if you get the metal ones,
that's true. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed on the A220 when they serve you do they serve you a full meal?
Yeah, they served a full meal.
The cutlery there, it's but, like, but
the
almost
cutlery,
like
the cutlery is weird.
Chubby cutlery.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting design. It's actually quite interesting though, because the way you hold the cutlery, it's carved. And I think if you're a left-hander and you use your knife with your left hand rather than your right, it doesn't work. But if you use it right-handed, your finger sort of, it's carved out, so your finger sort of slides into that carve and it's a bit more comfortable to use.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, I have a pretty low, as I've said, opinion of airline food. My basically, I have two standards, edible and inedible.
Yeah,
yeah, fair.
In fact, when I mentioned the LATAM flight earlier, you know, that was actually, it was economy, but it was pretty simple. It was really nice. I actually said to my wife, I think it was one of the best economy meals I can remember having. It was very nice. But it was quite simple. It was a simple pasta dish, but most of the stuff, I know coming back from New Zealand a couple of weeks later, we came Qantas and
on the 7-3, Trans-Tasman on the narrow body.
It was just disgusting. I couldn't eat anything. All of it was just revolting. So
I think Qantas food is not bad. I just think their portions are very small.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah. I've rarely had decent food with QF. The only thing I've ever had that was memorably good with QF was the business class teriyaki chicken with sticky rice going to Canberra, actually, on the 7-3.
Yeah, I tend to remember the lounge food, actually, more than the airline food.
I remember the Abu Dhabi. Eddie had a lounge in Abu Dhabi years ago at the old, yet somehow current, Abu Dhabi terminal. And that was insane.
Well, the Emirates, the food there. The main business class lounge at Dubai, it's just the biggest business class lounge. I don't know, have you been there?
I've been.
It is massive.
Yeah, it's the entire terminal. It's literally huge. A terminal in its own right. Yeah. It's massive.
But they were all sorts of quirky things. They had like an ice cream cart inside the lounge. You can go up the ice cream cart.
There's literally this Moët and Chandon bar, and it's literally just like they only serve exclusively Moët and Chandon.
Are you serious?
And it's like got this gold thing in the back, and it's insane.
What?
Yeah.
I can't. I want to go There's so many. Well, I mean, there's so much in aviation I want to explore and discover. But that's near the top.
Yeah.
The Dubai Emirates Lounge, yeah.
Yeah. Insane. I'd say my favorite meal I've ever had. Like, honestly, it was a Cathay Pacific economy meal. It was pork chop and rice, and honestly, it tasted exactly how you would in a local Hong Kong cafe. Like the taste was on point. Like, I feel as though with sort of overly sort of flavorful foods on airlines, they tend to oversalt it to compensate for the altitude.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they do.
I didn't know that.
But this one was literally perfect. Like, obviously, you unboxed it, and as all economy meals, they don't look that appetizing, to be honest. It kind of just looks like a dog's breakfast.
Sloppy jalopy, yeah.
Yeah, but the taste of it was fantastic. Honestly, the rice was great. It was just really good. Most memorable one I've ever had. So there you go, Rose. That was our airline food comparison. Hope you like that. Going on to more of Vince's questions. Why do they not serve sausage rolls on all flights? Because they've got to get rid of the quiches at Donati Catering.
Yep, correct.
What rows are PowerPoints I need to plug in my sleep apnea machine? I'll tell you what, Vince. On most long-haul carriers in economy, like full service, there is generally a 70-watt power port, universal power port, between two seats.
I could not tell you the wattage of the power. That's pretty impressive.
If you were in a row of three, there should be two in between you. If you're in a row of four, there should be three. So it's basically one per two.
That's
generally how it works.
Is she taking the mic there? I mean, seriously,
Bray's definitely taking the mickey. This is classic Vince right here. What else is
there? Next question is losing circulation in your legs due to the shittest design known to man. I mean, DVT is a real issue though in airlines. Like, particularly on airlines like Qantas, there's an entire section in their magazine dedicated to how to combat deep vein thrombosis on flights. And I would say just get up. Do a bit of stretching every so often. Walk around the aircraft. That's what I did.
LAX to Auckland once, 14 and a half hours, I think it was, in United Economy. I did not get up once, even to go to the toilet. I literally sat down and I got up in Auckland 15 hours later.
Oh my gosh, I could never do that.
I was a bit next to the window, so whatever.
I could never do that. I'd need to get up. I feel as though after like a sort of hour and a half, 2 hours in economy, I start cramping up. I just need to get up.
Well, we're all tall as well, and that makes a big difference. And some of those, LATAM Airlines, really good leg room in economy. Mm. Yeah, it was really... But
Melbourne Christchurch in an A320, that killed my legs.
Melbourne Christchurch?
In an A320, killed my legs.
Coming back from New Zealand last month on this 737 Qantas, and we were last on the plane because we're on staff travel, and it was a bit of fluffing around with the seats. You know, we were told we couldn't get on, then we told we were, so we went right down the back. We passed row 13, which is, you know, is the exit aisle seats on the 7, and there were two seats right there. I said, I can sit there, exit aisle. Oh no, you've been allocated a seat under row 30, 31, whatever, it's the back row. So I get down, there's two seats there, and I'm going to be in the middle one. My wife's going to be in the aisle, and up against the window is this 160-kilo Tongan guy. And a very friendly guy, but he just like sat down. Of course, he's trying his best to stay in his own seat, but he's just so huge. And so I end up having to put the armrest up and squash with my wife in there for 4 hours in the back of this dodgy little 737. It was very, very uncomfortable. And then I say the food was completely inedible. It was the worst flight I've ever had. I think
it's funny you mentioned massive Tongan guy, because one of the questions that Vince has actually asked us, of the many ones he's asked us, is what is the BMI standard for a shit seat at the back of the plane asking for a fat friend? And I say this, if your ass takes up more than one seat, buy a second one. Or sit in, like, if you can afford it, premium economy or something. But usually, just buy a second seat.
Do you see that all the airlines doing the April Fool's pranks? Emirates did one where it's like... Emirates residences, and it's like
I saw that
the massive skyscraper, and they've got the runways on level 80 of the skyscraper, and then Jetstar did now you can reserve your armrest in advance for an additional $2 at purchase.
Yeah, on that LATAM flight, there was a guy who is the biggest human being I've ever seen.
Really,
at least 7 foot tall. Again, Polynesian guy, just massive, massive human being.
Mm.
And he actually flew business. And I could see him through in the front of economy. I could see him in business. His shoulders were clearly above the top of the seat.
Business would be too tight for him.
Well,
it would have been too tight for him. 7 foot. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, they're quite good leg room, actually. In the, there was real old school business class in LATAM that they designed. There was a lot of leg room, and they're really square, sort of boxy seats. But he, I say, he was so tall that his shoulders were several inches above the top of the seat before he even got to his head. And I thought he simply wouldn't have sat fitted in an economy seat. So
imagine him trying to fit into the old BA herringbone.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's the worst. I've done that.
Yeah,
I've done that Gatwick to Bermuda on that. It's just, as Dennis Bannock says, the best airlines. You know, Dennis Bannock always says, you know,
yeah,
ones on the window good for traveling by yourself, and the best ones for couples in the middle. When he reviewed that herringbone one, he says the best seats for couples are on a different airline.
Yeah, gold, yeah, absolute
he's
gold.
Really good, Dennis Bannock is. Yeah, he is really good.
Yeah, it's quite funny.
Shout out Bannock Tours.
Yeah. Bannock Tours, Bannock, that's it.
Yeah, that's the company he owns.
Really?
Yeah, he owns a company called Bunnick Tours, it's a
family business. His mum started up.
Yeah.
There you go.
All right, getting through the last few, Vince's questions. You need to put bread rolls in sausage rolls with sauce.
Oh, he's still
it
going.
It tastes like this. Magic, sure. Why can't they set up a sports bar at the back of the plane and a burger bar too? I think the closest thing that they've ever done is on the 380 with some airlines like Qatar, Etihad, and Emirates. They've set up an actual fancy bar, but I don't know, maybe...
You can get live sports on some airlines now, which is an improvement.
Yeah, you can.
I watched Sport the F1 24. Live on the A220 on the way home. But yes, no, sports bar specifically.
Sports bar specifically.
Jeez. Yeah.
Bit of darts.
Darts on board the aircraft. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Bit of turbulence halfway through. Whoa.
Yeah.
One.
Dennis said, Michael Area, we're going to take out the toilet so we can put in a 6'4" pool table.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, oh, my.
Stand around it and pay $10 to be on the aircraft.
Pay $10 to go to the toilet, but gets you a free use of the pool table.
All right, two more questions from him.
Come on, Vince.
Why can't you use reverse thrust to get out of a gate rather than using a tug? You can, but... Greenpeace wouldn't be happy with it.
We can't
upset Greenpeace.
You can, but it's very possible, but that the windows in the gate latch will shatter.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You don't want that sort of force in and around buildings and equipment and stuff. So.
That's right.
Nah. But you know, I'd love to see that happen one day though, with an aircraft just really remote stand, just start reversing out of it. That would be cool though.
Yeah,
I've always thought of that though. But yeah.
Do it like Harrier Jump Jet style. Just like start levitating from the gate, from the pad, just up and then.
Yeah, literally. Out. Yeah. Last question from Vince is, where is the car wash for an aircraft? Usually in the hangars.
True, there actually is. I know that's meant as a pseudo joke, but there actually is like jet wash. Like, you know, take it in to the hangar for a good old washeroo.
There are technologies where you can actually wash aircraft without using any water. Emirates have done that for a little while now, to be honest.
Yep.
It's quite interesting how they do it.
They don't actually wash the planes in the hangar. They might be outside. They have a bay outside because the hangar is just full of water and soap, do you?
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's true. I suppose they don't often... Or do they often have to wash the aircraft? I don't know.
It depends on what airline. I can list a bunch of airlines that definitely wash their aircraft and a bunch of airlines that definitely don't.
Malaysian airlines.
That have never touched it. It's sad, but Cathay have really got some dirty aircraft. Like their 330s.
Yeah. Oh,
man, they are not.
Sometimes I consider it a bonus of actually vacuuming inside the aircraft.
Oh. Yeah, again, that was another thing on the 330, right? Was it non-stop Dan did a review of the A330, of the Cathay A330 and in their business class, and he noted that, or maybe it was a 777. Anyway, he noted that the business class seats, it was just gunk and filth all in the gaps everywhere.
Mm. Typically, domestic are worse in the sense that obviously you don't clean the aircraft after every leg, and domestic, the flight crew come along and ask for all the rubbish.
Yeah, true.
No, I did notice that on my 220 home on X4 Bravo. There was a lot of crumb. Do you know where the armrest is? And just below that, you've got that really
charging
cool
station.
Yeah, that was full of crumbs.
Really?
Yeah, it was full of crumbs. To be fair, the aircraft was running late, and that obviously
Vince sitting in the seat before you, did he?
Yeah. Too many pies. Yeah,
sausage roll crumbs.
Yeah, sausage roll crumbs.
That's right. But obviously the aircraft came in
late, and they did everything they can to try turn around the aircraft, you know, quickly. And one of the things they overlooked was the cleaning of it. I'm not too fussed about that, to be honest.
No, true.
The seat itself was clean. It was just that little small little section and that gap in that panel. It was just. But I'm sure
it's quite a range. You get crumbs up through that one. Lastly, with the biohazard because the person uncontrolled diarrhea.
And whoa, my gosh, oh, that's right. The flight that turned back to Atlanta, the Delta flight.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Diverteria.
Hey, that's true. That's gosh, crazy. Yeah. Well, that was all our questions done. Thank you very much, Vince.
Thank you, Gabby, Flynn, and Vince for the good questions.
Yeah.
And thank you, Scott, for coming on this week. Thanks, Dad. It was been a pleasure to finally have you on.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And it, it's been
a pleasure to be back, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It's been a pleasure to see the fact checker in real life, you know, rather than having, like, putting out a podcast and then 2 minutes later getting a message from Scott Conway being like, oh, yeah, Nick messed up this fact. I'm like, ah, oh, man.
Yeah.
In fairness, Nick, it's not you that's mixed up the facts most of the time.
It's me, yeah.
Or Ross. That's why he's not here today.
Like when I said on the podcast, I said, oh, yeah, the time Dad went to Kaitak. He's never been to Kaitak. He's never flown into Kaitak. Whoopsies.
I've been to the new Hong Kong airport lots of times, but not the
Chip Blackhawk, yeah.
Not the old one. Yeah.
There you go. Yes. Well, thank you everyone for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed having us back. We've enjoyed being back, and we'll be back again for another episode very soon, I'm sure. Hopefully we can catch Christos and Ross alongside us for the next episode.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
And until next time, goodbye.
See ya.